Hi, everyone. Excited to get to learn with some people that I haven't yet gotten to learn with. So if we haven't met yet, then you'll tell me your name as we start the learning. I will pass these out, but we're going to do something before we start reading. So just because you have the handout doesn't mean you should read it just yet. So I called this session in a somewhat, you know, to try to get all of your attention. Who is a Jewish insider? Or how do we know which Jews we can trust? And it's a topic that I have been turning over and thinking about in different contexts. I think that who we can trust is feeling maybe harder and harder than it in recent years. And in particular, within the Jewish community, the idea of like, you know, can you trust someone just because they're Jewish? We're starting to ask that question in different ways. I knew someone who converted, and I remember him saying that he was told, like, now that you've converted, if you're ever lost or in trouble and you see a mezuzah on a door, you can always knock on that door and that person will help you. That's like something you have available to you now that you've converted, now that you're a Jew. And I remember being sort of surprised. I had never thought about that, and also being sort of moved by that. And is that true? Is that good advice? And does it feel different now than it did maybe 10, 20 years ago? I don't know. Those are all sort of interesting questions. I guess I want us to start from an assumption that in order to function, and I think one of the points I want to make in this class, and we'll look at the sources to get there, but I like to just say the point of the class right from the beginning so you don't miss it. In order to have a functioning religious life, you have to find people that you trust. Like, you will have to find the people that you trust. That is a prerequisite for having a functioning religious life. Probably we can extend that to just say, in order to function in life, we have to be able to find a group of people that we trust. So I'll say, like, step one is, what do we need? How do we find the group of people and make sure that that allows us to live our religious lives? And then step two that we're going to get to is, when do we need to actually break out of those boundaries and push back on the sort of comfort level that we've come to expect with who we can trust and who we can't? You have a question?
I don't want to derail you, but I just don't have trust to do what?
Yeah, great. Perfect question.
Okay,
I was going to say, before we start, I want to do a go-around. I want to hear people ask, and I think we'll do this. I want you to answer three questions. I'll give you a minute to answer them first for yourself, and then I'm going to ask you to share just with the person next to you, and then we'll hear a couple for the group just because of the size. But I really want everyone to answer this question for yourself so that you'll have an answer to start with. These are my three questions. The first is, who is someone that you trust? And I'm asking you, you don't have to tell us their name, but I'm asking you to think of a specific person in your life. Like, who is a specific person that you trust? That's question one. Question two is, what allows you to trust them? Like, what is it that allows you to trust this person? And then question three, Harman, which will speak to your question, is, what does this trust allow you to do together? Who has an answer you want to share with us? We'll take maybe two or three answers just to get them out into the room. Who do you trust? What allows you to trust them? And what does that trust allow you to do together? And you'll give me like a brief answer.
A friend that I never feel judged by.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't judge each other. And so we feel like we share things with each other that we can't share with other friends of ours.
Got it. So the thing that makes you able to trust them is that you know you won't be judged.
Yes.
And what it allows you to do is to share more.
Yeah,
great. So again, I feel like we could have lifted probably several different examples from the Talmud of different sort of communities of trust. This is the one that I learned about and just find to be really striking and interesting, and it's not particularly talked about. So these are the two categories. And I'll say the categories are chaverim and Am Ha'aretz, or Amei Ha'aretz. These words are both used now sometimes to mean different things than what they mean when you read them in the Mishnah. So we'll go over what they mean in the Mishnah. And even there, scholars aren't 100% in agreement on exactly what they mean when they're used in the Mishnah. I know because I checked with Jeremy Tavik, who's my go-to, like, but what do they mean when it was said in the Mishnah, if you're just coming from his Mishnah class? So Chaverim, and I gave you sort of the Steinsaltz reference guide official definitions of what these categories are, but I'm not going to read the paragraphs. I'm just going to sort of describe it to you, but you'll see here, these are the definitions. The Chaverim, so this is the word Chaver, friend, your Chevre, or your people. The Chaverim are a group of people who are all signed up for the same project. These are people who are all signed up to follow a particular set of laws, and those are laws about ritual purity. Okay, they're signed up to follow the ritual purity laws, like in a particularly strict kind of way. Right? You might think of this as like, it's like in a world of vegetarians, they're the vegans. It's like they have some common understanding of what the rules are that they all know and that they all subscribe to. Those are the Chaverim. The people who are Amei Haaretz are the people who are not the Chaverim. They are not signed up for this particular set of laws. And that could be because they don't know the laws, or that could be because they chose not to follow them, right? It's easy to slip into kashrut metaphors here because the ritual purity laws come up with food a lot. It's different than kashrut, so I'll just keep reminding us that, but it's easy to think about, like, you could be in someone's home who doesn't keep kosher. Maybe they don't keep kosher because they don't know the laws of kashrut, or the kashrut laws have nothing to do with them. Or maybe they don't keep kosher because they know the laws of kashrut perfectly well and they're choosing not to keep kosher. But so the Amei Haaretz can be for different reasons. I'll say, like, if you've heard the phrase now, sometimes Am Haaretz can be used as like a pejorative way of saying like person who doesn't know anything, like, ugh, they're an Am Haaretz, they're unlearned. My understanding is that's not what it means when it's used in the Mishnah. Even when it's used in the Mishnah to mean a person who doesn't know the law, it's not used in a pejorative, like, they should know better and know the law. It's just a sort of an indication of, like, this is a person who doesn't know. Yeah.
Just a footnote. Biblically, that's different. I learned that very recently.
Yeah.
Haaretz does not mean what we think is either ignorant or somebody who doesn't. You can't trust for Maaseh,
yeah.
Which I think is weird.
What it means here, yeah.
It could be rather prominent people in the society.
Yeah, like the person of the land, right? Yeah, so Am Haaretz is like person of the land. Yeah, right.
It's not so low as you might think.
Right, so this means like something biblically, just to really confuse you if you're new to Hebrew and trying to learn. It means something different rabbinically than biblically and different rabbinically from now. So we're looking at the sort of rabbinic framework.
Right.
And just in order to say that the way these words are used are not uniformly the same, is that like even within these definitions, I think he says acceptance as a chaver removed the individual from the category of Am Haaretz in the definition of chaver. And then he says, like in the second one, some Chaverim are also Amei Haaretz. Like, he's not even sure, even in these two definitions, whether you can be in both categories or whether you're one or the other, just to sort of say. And then the last thing I'll just name is that these are not active. This is not a halakha shir. We're not talking about the active legal categories of Chaver and Amei Haaretz and purity laws. We're going to explore it as a framework for trust and what we can learn from that. You want to say something?
Yeah, so I just noticed that in the first definition, Steinsaltz refers to the Talmudic period, and in the second definition, the first definition.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if that's. You know,
yeah, that's interesting.
And
yeah.
Because, you know, in the Kevo Dasel Harab Knelech Haber, I've never understood that to mean.
Friend?
No, I've never understood it to mean friend, but I've also never understood it to mean someone on.
Like a technical, yeah, that's interesting. I will be interested. I haven't thought about that Mishnah with regard to this framework, but it will be interesting to come back to that actually and ask whether that could mean person that you trust, you know, at a higher level. Okay, I picked a few Mishnayot. We're going to read a few Mishnayot. Again, I like to say if you are a person who has only read some Mishnah, you've probably not read these. And if you are a person who's read a lot of Mishnah, you probably have also not read these. Mishnah Demai is like not up there in the greatest hits of Mishnayot. But I think they're really interesting. And again, I'm just picking a few of these here to help us get a sense of the category so that we can then better understand the piece of Gemara I want us to look at next that is going to encourage us to like push on the boundaries of the category. Yeah.
No, I was just thinking about what you said. Just thinking of it, like you're talking about insiders. It would have been a more elite group of people. So maybe there was this feeling of being an insider in this group as just like the way it's translated in Pirkei Avot is just like your fellow.
Yeah.
But maybe it's like your insider group.
Right. Also, I think an interesting question for us to ask will be like, does insider mean elite, right? Like,
yeah.
Can you have, you know, if I say like there's an in-group and an out-group, that sounds like a problem, right? Yeah. But if I say like, yeah, you have your close-knit friends, that's not inherently, that doesn't necessarily have an inherent hierarchy, right? We might say like everyone should have some close friends. That doesn't make you elite because you have some people that you are closer with. And I think that will also be a question that, you know, we can sort of, that you can, you'll feel some of that tension in the Mishnah trying to figure that out. Okay, so someone read for us in the English this first Mishnah here on page 2 that starts, one who takes it upon himself to be a chaver. Who wants to read?
One who takes it upon himself to be a chaver, one who scrupulously observes tithes and purity laws, may not sell to an ignorant person wet or dry produce, nor buy from him wet produce, nor be the guest of an am haaretz, nor host him as a guest when he is clothed in his own garments. Rabbi Yehuda says, you may not even raise small animals, nor be unrestrained regarding vows and entertainment, nor become defiled by contact with a corpse, and frequent the house of study. They said to him, these are not included in the general principle.
Okay.
Does everybody have to have the FM radio voice?
I know. You're going to have to read everything. That was great. Here's some things I want to point out here. The first thing I want to point out is Hamikabel Alav Lihiyot Chaver, right? This is an opt-in category. So I think that's interesting even on its own in terms of like, if you frame it as who's a Jewish insider, right, who's a chaver, is to say like, well, maybe one element is like it's people who opt in to being a chaver. So that's one point I think we want to make. And then to say like the chaver are the people that opted into the same system. And what does that allow them to do together? It allows them to eat together, right? You can't host the Am Haaretz. You can't be a guest in their home or host them as a guest. And also it matters what you're wearing. Are you wearing their clothes or your clothes? It's just was striking to me to think, like, how do we judge people, whether they're an insider or an outsider? Like, we're not using these purity laws. And a fundamental message of, like, well, what do they eat and what do they wear? Like, those are also some of the first indicators that we look at and think about in terms of a person, like, okay, you know, what do you eat? What do you wear? Do I feel like we're bought into similar sort of social norms and projects? That those are some of those questions that come up for us in terms of figuring out, like, whose house do I want to go to for dinner? And who do I want to have in my house for dinner? So we sort of start off with, like, there's a group that people opt into. There are some real distinctions between what you can do with those people and what you can do with other people. And then there's Rabbi Yehuda, right? And Rabbi Yehuda's like, and I think there's a lot more things that you can't do with someone who's an Am Haaretz, right? Don't raise small animals. Don't be unrestrained regarding vows and entertainment. The entertainment in particular is like, you know, you could feel it as like, don't hang out with them. Don't go to the movies with them. You know, don't go to their funerals or, you know, if they need you, don't defile yourself in order to help them bury their people. Don't go to their houses of study, right? Rabbi Yehuda seems to be like extending it. And then there's this sort of like voice that pulls him back that says like, no, like Rabbi Yehuda, you're getting carried away. Actually, this is a real set of laws. There are actual things you can't do together. And don't just extend that social category to then say, like, you know, again, in the kashrut metaphor, that which is not the same, but is a maybe a useful metaphor, that you would say, like, oh, just because you can't eat off of someone's dishes doesn't mean you can't learn with them, go to the movies with them, have all these other interactions with them. And maybe the Rebbe Yehuda instinct to say, like, let's get more and more insular and limit the things we do with other people. There's this voice pushing back to say, like, actually, limit the things you can't do to the things you can't do. And don't get carried away with, like, oh, I can only hang out with people who I have this, like, higher level of trust with. You know, maybe you want to be really thoughtful where you draw that line. Let's do one more Mishnah, Deborah, then I want to hear your comment. Okay, someone read for us a Chaver and an Am Haaretz. And you don't have to have a perfect radio voice. You're still allowed. Great. Okay.
A Chaver and Am Haaretz, one who is lax in observing purity laws, who inherited from their Am Haaretz father, he, the Chaver, you take the wheat from such and such area, and I the wheat from such and such area. You the wine from such and such area, and I the wine from such and such area. However, he may not say to him, you take the wheat and I the barley, you take the fresh and I take the dry.
Okay. First of all, I love about this Mishnah that it's such a good example of the way that the Mishnah gives you like a whole story in a tiny little, you know, a tiny little Mishnah that is ostensibly a halachic Mishnah, not a Gadic story Mishnah, but like we have a whole narrative here, right? You could write the whole short story of like, who's the family and what's happening here? A chaver and an am haaretz who inherited from their am haaretz father. Another thing I feel really makes this Mishnah useful is that it, lest you thought that these categories were groups of families, right? There's chaverim families, and there are am haaretz families. They are brothers, right? The chaver and the am haaretz here are not strangers. They're not enemies. They are literally brothers. To know that this kind of divide happens within families, which again, it's not a perfect parallel, right? But when you say, like, and it's like, you know, a Reformed Jew and an Orthodox Jew, I'm like, okay, they're totally different. And then I'm like, who are brothers? And it reminds you that, like, actually these divide, you know, we can have this imagination that the people have opted into categories are so static. The father is also Am Haaretz, so presumably the chaver is the one who opted in to have a different practice. I know in my morning class also I keep bringing examples of children who are opting into a different practice. You know, Avraham is smashing his father's idols. It's maybe more dramatic than here. But just for us to remember that, like, yeah, again, we can imagine that there was never any subdivides in the Jewish world. We could imagine that families obviously are in one category or the other. The Mishnah has no pretense of that. This is all one family. And it seems to me that the sort of message of this Mishnah is that you know, they're trying to divide up the produce, which is complicated because the chaver is going to need the produce to be like tithed and have certain laws applied to it that the other one isn't. That they, chaver, just by stint of being chaver, doesn't get to say, like, I want to pick the things that are easier to tithe. Or he gets half of everything, right? He's not entitled to any kind of like special status because he is a chaver. It still has to be fair. Right, that even the Mishnah, which you might think would prioritize the chaver, is saying, like, actually the chaver doesn't get to, you know, sort of like there isn't the firmest common denominator rule here, but it's not exactly that again. But it's like there is some sort of equality that needs to happen here. I want to ask this before we read this Talmud text: would you expect the holiday of Passover to shrink or expand the circle of trust, right? Okay, we got some shrink and we got some expand. So let's hear we'll hear someone speak on behalf of shrink and someone speak on behalf of expand. Okay, Miriam, you'll be shrink. Who wants to speak on expand?
So yeah, for shrink with Passover, it's like so people are so specific in the way that they practice and observe. And and then they're like, well, you know, I don't want to leave my house because I don't know that you're peeling all your vegetables before you cook with them or whatever else they're doing. Or I feel like they're very strict.
Yeah, we love to be strict about Passover, right? So many people who are, you know, oh, maybe you have kidney yod and I don't have kidney yod, therefore I don't trust your home. Maybe you didn't kosher exactly the way I kosher. Maybe I changed over the dishes and you don't change over the dishes.
Maybe there's the way that you do your Seder. People are super traditional and and need to read everything in the Haggadah, and other people are like, we just want the spirit of it.
Exactly. Maybe you have a karpas plate that I don't think is acceptable. there are so many possible, so many different possible problems that we could have. Okay, so now speak on behalf of Expand. Why would your trust expand?
To me, it reminds me I was not good at math. But if I knew I had a math test, then I would study the rules that applied to the math test, and then I could do it.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of very specific rules. You can find them anywhere. You follow those rules, you're done. So it's a smaller universe. And at the end of page 3, all I have are
Hey, you can't give away. You're not allowed to read it. I want your instinctive answer. Right.
My instinctive answer is that because it's a narrower circle, you only go to, it's not, you know whose house you're going to face And so you have faith in them and you think, okay, you know the narrow circle, I know the narrow circle.
You're like, this is such a specific mitzvah.
Yeah, what you said.
Yeah. It's so interesting, right? On the one hand, there are so many of us that get more strict around Pesach, and that your instinct is to trust fewer people. And also, the reason you might trust more people is because so many people get strict around Pesach, right? It's like, it is the case, actually. I always think if you thought of the, like, observing Pesach as like, is there matzah in your home? You know, that you'd say like, well, actually, a lot of Jews that you would never think would have matzah in their home have matzah in their home, right? Jews who are not keeping kosher, I'm from the South. In the South, there's like a whole, it's very normal, actually, in the South for people who never keep kosher during the year. They keep kosher on Pesach. Like, they buy kosher meat for their Seder because there is something about Passover that, like, makes people more, observe more strictly. It's like when you hear these studies that say more Jews observe the Seder than any other ritual, you might think, like, that's crazy. The Seder is the hardest one. Why are they picking the hardest one? That makes me think I wouldn't trust them because it's really hard and it's a lot of work. And also, somehow, there is actually a phenomenon. Okay, so I want us to read this text, and then we'll see, like, where we see this reflected in our lives. Okay, this is from Psachim, and I think it's just an amazing, it's amazing Passover Torah, and maybe it can also push us on trust. So somebody read for us. You'll start from Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak was asked. And I'll do some interrupting to explain what the Talmud is talking about.
All right. Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak was asked, if one rents a house to his neighbor on the 14th, does it stand in presumption of having been served or not?
Okay. The 14th is the night of Seder. Okay. This is like, I'm renting a house. You'll bear with the premise, right? I'm renting a house, and the rental starts. This is my Pesach Airbnb, right? I'm going to move in. The rental will start on the night of the first Seder. I'm renting from a Jewish person. Can I presume that they cleaned for Pesach before I moved into my Pesach rental? Has it been searched? Right. Okay. Keep going.
What difference does it make? Just ask him.
Seems like a really logical response, right? You should probably clarify that with the landlord.
Right. So the response to that is, he's not present to be asked. Hence, what about troubling the tenant? Okay, so the tenant can ask the landlord.
So that's the question. It was like, if he could have asked him, he would have asked him. Back to the question. Can he? Right.
Can we assume that he did it, or should we not? Said Rabbi Nachman Ben Yitzchak to them, we have a teaching. All are believed concerning the removal of leaven. even women, even slaves, even minor.
Okay. Before we take offense, we'll just say, what do women, slaves, and minors have in common? Just sub in even people who can't give testimony normally. Okay? We're not going to get into, like, why these people can't give testimony. But when you see a triplicate like this, you can know that we're not talking specifically about any one of those categories. There's, you know, orphan, widow, stranger, you mean vulnerable people. You know, not every widow is vulnerable. Not every orphan is vulnerable. But when you say orphan, widow, stranger, you mean vulnerable people. Here, when you say women, slaves, minors, you mean people who couldn't otherwise give testimony. Okay, so everyone is believed about cleaning for Pesach, even people who can't otherwise give testimony.
Okay. Now that still doesn't help because they're not there to be asked.
True. Well, or maybe they're there, like yep. The tenant's just not there. The landlord's not there.
Now, why are they believed? Is it not because it stands in the presumption of having been searched? As the Tana holds, all are chaverim in respect to the searching of leaven.
Okay. So we just said to ourselves, we just studied all these Mishnayot, right? About like chaverim, and you have to opt in, and it's so important, and you keep all these distinctions and all these barriers. And then we get this statement, like, well, but when it comes to cleaning for Pesach, hakol chaverim hem, everyone is chaverim, right? There is something about Pesach that makes you consider everyone a chaver. And I want us to do this last line so we can see, like, how extreme. It sounds extreme already. It's going to get even more extreme. So read this last line, for it was taught.
For it was taught, if a chaver dies and leaves a storehouse full of produce, even if they are but one day old, they stand in the presumption of having been tied.
Okay. Here's this statement about chaverim, right? If a chaver dies and they leave a storehouse full of produce, and you come up and you're trying to figure out whether the produce was tithed or not, okay? A chaver is a person who is very meticulous about tithing, right? So the rule is, if the thing you're inheriting is coming from a chaver, you always assume it was tithed, because the definition of chaver is someone who is meticulous about tithing. But this tells us, it's one day old, right? Literally, the storehouse was stocked the day the guy was dying, right? He was very unlikely, / it's impossible that he actually tithed, because he was busy dying, right? He wasn't able to tithe, and yet we trust it. We assume it was tithed, because the trust we have in chaverim, it's not just that we have trust in chaverim, we actually have trust that goes even beyond sort of like rationality, right? And I wonder, if I think back to like my opening question, if I say like, who's the person you trust, right? That first person that comes to mind that you really trust, right? That like that is a person that you trust so much that if I was to say like, well, there's evidence against them, you would say like, I trust them. Like, my trust for that person is actually beyond the evidence that you're showing me. That's the level of trust that we're talking about for the chaverim. And that sort of like supernatural, as in like it's impossible that he could have done it, level trust, is the trust that you should then at Pesach time suddenly apply to all the Jewish people. You know, everybody is a chaver now. Everybody gets this sort of like, well, it's probably not likely that they could have actually cleaned for Pesach, but we're just going to assume that they did, because all Jews are chaverim when it comes to Pesach. So we did all this building up in the Mishnah of what chaverim are, and now Pesach has this magical ability to bust that apart, to push us out. So my question is, like, maybe the first question is, like, what does this teach us about Pesach if we apply it to, like, well, I won't say my answer. I'll start with a question. Like, what do you see in this? What about Pesach? Why does this make sense to you? And or why is it shocking? Yeah.
Is it that having chaverim is a desired state, and you're saying basically, let's not mess with it. Let's try and do all we can to maintain that relationship?
Meaning we want more of them.
Let's not deal with the technicality whether or not they did. Yeah. Let's assume they did. Yeah. It's more important that we're a chaverim than that they did or did not tie, that they did or did not.
Yeah. I think that's I think that's here, right? I think about people who, and maybe someone in this room is like, there are Jews who are moved by the concept of peoplehood. It's of such a high value that you would actually say, like, yeah, I know not all Jews are doing all the right things at all the right moments. Like, I know that to be true. And I still want to maintain that, like, I can knock on your door if you have a mezuzah and you'll help me because I want chaverim. I want the people to be chaverim. I want to believe that everyone is chaverim. And maybe there's something about Pesach in particular as a peoplehood holiday that we want it to be able to connect us. There was something in your definition of why we should trust, which was you were like, well, you're going to someone's house for Passover and you just trust them. Like, if somebody invites you for a Seder, you just don't ask too many follow-ups. You don't say, like, but are you going to read every word of the Haggadah? Like, you know, yeah, well, you can give those people this Gemara. I do think, like, the question when I read this, the question of is this meant to be read, like, prescriptively or descriptively about Pesach, right? Is it descriptive? Like, on Pesach, you can trust everyone because everyone actually cleans for Pesach, which, again, I'm trying to make the case, like, yeah, actually, even now, there's something of that, right? There are all these people who do Pesach, not cleaning necessarily, but they have matzah or they go to a Seder. You're like, who are all these people? It's like, there are people who come out of the woodwork for Pesach. That's maybe descriptive. And when is it prescriptive, right? When is it saying, like, you just have to consider them chaverim? And then to ask, like, on the one hand, what can this teach us about Pesach? Like, if you hold this and think about this text, hopefully while you are doing whatever cleaning it is you do for Passover this year, you'll have in the back of your mind this text. But then also beyond Passover is to say, like, why? What does it mean if I say, like, one of the main things I learned from the Chaver Ha'aretz distinction is that actually sometimes you need to find your people in order to have a religious life, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we did a Responsa Radio episode once that was like, if we have a minyan, but we don't, not everybody counts everybody in the minyan, but how do we know that everyone who's in the minyan is willing to count themselves? And they had made an elaborate system of, like, there are 10 books on the shelf, and if you're willing to count yourself in the minyan, you should take one of the books off the shelf. And then when there are no books on the shelf, we'll know that there are 10 people in the room who count themselves in the minyan so that we don't accidentally count you if you don't. It's like, that is exhausting. Wouldn't it be nice to just, like, know that you can count everyone in the room? Like, sometimes you have to be able to just go into someone's home and eat and not, like, pick up the package and check if it's kosher or worry that they cooked meat, put meat in your vegetarian food or whatever it is, the thing, you know, not worry that you can't make a joke that will be offensive to Republicans because you don't know if someone's in the room, or offensive to Democrats because you don't know if someone's in the room. Like, sometimes you need to find your people. And you have to find the moments and times when you are going to push beyond that and when you are going to push yourself to say, like, all are chaverim. What does it look like to, like, who are the Jews that I trust? And when are the moments when I have to actually create a broader sense of trust in the Jewish people and push myself to say, like, for this thing, everyone will be considered a chaver. I hope that that's, like, a helpful question to leave you with.